Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. Caroline has said a wee bit about me, and I'm just going to start off by talking a bit about myself and a bit about my background. Not because I have any desire to talk about myself, but because the story of a novel is in some ways the story of myself. And whenever you sit down to write a novel, what you write about really is very much based on your own personal experience. So it was a journey, in a way, in my own life that led me to writing the novel, and I'll go on to that just in a few moments. But a very brief introduction, as Caroline said, is that I'm Colin Neil, and I'm married to Claire, and I have two children, Matt, who's 11, and Susie, who's 9. You shouldn't really have to look at your notes when you're saying who your children are and what age you are. And sometimes people ask me, well, how do you find time to write a book? And the answer is that you can only find so much time, but you've also actually got to be given time. And I must say that Claire was tremendously supportive and a really big part of making Tourass happen. I was born in Lurgan, and I now live in Warringstown, which is just 2 miles from Lurgan. And they say that a Warringstown man is a Lurgan man with a mortgage, which is exactly what I've become. And my local church is Warringstown Presbyterian, and whilst I would never set my church on a pedestal or defend it as being in any way without fault, I can genuinely say that I enjoy worshipping God in Warringstown Presbyterian and being part of that church family, and it's nice to see a few people from Warringstown here tonight. Professionally, I work just about a minute away in Investment Rhode Island in Bedford Street. So in terms of some of my background, which feeds into Tourass and how I came to write Tourass, my childhood church was First Lurgan Presbyterian, and I made a profession of faith at First Lurgan in 1984 at an activity which was part of a whole range of things at First Lurgan were doing to mark the tercentenary of that congregation. And where my personal journey towards this book really started then was in 1991, whenever I went to the University of Ulster at Jordanstown to study communication, advertising and marketing. And while I was there, I went to two different organisations and sort of explored my Christian faith down two routes. I went to both a Christian Union, and I also got involved in the chaplaincy. And some of you may know that the chaplaincy of the University of Ulster has the four main churches. That's Presbyterian, Methodist, Church of Ireland and Roman Catholic, all working together out of a one chaplaincy. And it's funny, whenever I was writing that particular part of the notes, I was thinking about that phrase, four main churches, and wondering how relevant that still is and how relevant that's going to be in the years to come as this province changes. But those years at Jordanstown were very formative years, where it was interesting in the sense that I became much more at home in the chaplaincy than the Christian Union, because it seemed, at least in my experience, that a lot of people in the CU probably weren't that interested in me as a person, particularly if I didn't share with unqualified enthusiasm the good CU's goal of converting the entire campus to faith in Jesus Christ. And actually, if you were a bit insecure or a bit lonely, then I'm not sure that the CU was actually the best place to be around. And in hindsight, what I probably wanted was a church, and CUs, for all they were designed to be, are not churches. But in contrast, the chaplaincy's purpose was all about promoting understanding, particularly between Protestants and Catholics. And I soon became involved in all sorts of activities in the chaplaincy, and bridge building sessions and weekends away at places like Corrymeela. And it was fantastic in the sense that this was a place where there was no agenda, and forming a relationship with someone wasn't about making them some kind of target board and winning their soul to Christ. Forming a relationship with someone was just about getting to know them and hear their story, and you getting to know their story. And that, therefore, was actually a much, much more accepting place, I felt anyhow, than the Christian Union ever was. But of course, there were touch points between the two organisations. And there was an element for me, certainly, of having to justify myself to the CU crowd for wanting to be involved in the chaplaincy, because the chaplaincy was seen as being all woolly and liberal and vague. And seemingly, if you were involved in the chaplaincy, you were condoning the doctrinal error of other people and all of those things. And I was very, very struck at that time by particular Christians who I would say were very positive and open in how they lived out their Christian faith, and other Christians who, to me, defined themselves much more by being defensive on what it was that they were against. Now, that's a long preamble, but it is important because it explains an awful lot of the story of Tuaras and what it is that led up to me writing the book. Now, in terms of where exactly the book came from, it's interesting to know that I have a big birthday coming up in a few months' time. I'm going to hit the big 4-0, and I had tea with a friend tonight in Pizza Express, and we were talking about sports cars and buying sports cars, so that's obviously the onset of a midlife crisis. But 10 years ago, whenever I turned 30, I set myself two goals. I said to myself, right, by the time I'm 35, I want to have run a marathon, and I want to have written a book. And I ran the marathon Belfast in 2004, so I managed to do that. In terms of a book, I probably had a first draft by the time I was 35, but no more than that. But at the time that I set myself that goal, I had absolutely no idea what the book was going to be about. And I can't claim that there was anything in any way spiritual about that goal. Instead, I think it was just a cocktail of sort of craziness and vanity and curiosity as to whether it really is true that everyone does actually have a book in them. So I had one or two ideas for the book, but nothing that was really sticking. And then in 2004, I went on holiday to Donegal. And at the time that I went on this holiday to Donegal, I was reading one of Brian McLaren's New Kind of Christian trilogy. If you said you were reading a Brian McLaren book in certain gatherings, I'm sure you could be stoned in Northern Ireland, but no, that won't happen here. And a New Kind of Christian, it was really interesting because there were novels which really inspired or explored non-fiction themes in a fiction format. So I was very taken by Brian McLaren's style and approach, even though it was incredibly dense and implausible fiction in terms of some of the dialogue and, you know, the way that people got on and the conversations that they had. So I was reading this Brian McLaren book, and that was good on this holiday. But there was also less positive things were happening on that holiday. And things about myself and things that I was becoming aware of about myself that struck me. So I can remember feeling that I'd gone on holiday with the whole of West Belfast in terms of the people who I was bumping into and experiences that I was having. And I remember going into a convenience store wanting to get my good British newspaper and being faced with the Irish News and the Andersonstown News and just having one of those really good, bigoted moments where you think these people are everywhere and you can't get away from them. And that and a number of other things that went on the holiday just give me a real sense of, to use a good evangelical word, conviction about my own sense of just innate bigotry. And I run a lot, hence a marathon, and I walk a lot. And I can't remember if it was running or walking. I think it was actually walking. But I remember being out in this hillside in Donegal one afternoon on that holiday with the most fantastic view of scenery in front of me, and the aspiration to write my own novel and this Brian McLaren stuff that I was reading, but also more than anything the awareness of all my own values, good or bad, it all came together in what I could only describe as just a moment of epiphany or inspiration. And it came to me in an absolute instant. Why don't I take a set of Ulster Protestant friends and put them into United Ireland 10 or 15 years into the future and see how they get on. And that's where Turas came about. Now, that all sounds very grand, but there was, of course, a very pragmatic aspect to choosing to write a novel. And in a sense, Turas had to be fiction because I couldn't do anything else. And what I'm saying now is not in any way false modesty, because I think false modesty is an awful thing and it's very easy to see through. But it's simply the truth that I am not a historian and I'm not a theologian, and I am entirely unqualified to write a book about Northern Ireland and the Troubles. But people say that if you're going to write, you should write about something that you know best. And I am just, in my own view, an ordinary 5/8 Ulster Protestant. So that's what I wrote about. I wrote about these ordinary people dealing with something that they just don't want to have to deal with or face up to. But of course, the benefit as well of a novel format is that it gives scope to an imagination and a creativity in the way that all the themes are explored, in a sense that other forms don't, which is great as well, because I think sometimes as evangelicals in Northern Ireland, we're maybe not terribly imaginative in how it is that we go about exploring scripture and exploring the dilemmas in front of us. So fiction gave a bit of license that other forms wouldn't have done as well. And Turas, which as Caroline said, means journey in Irish. It was actually quite funny choosing the title, because as a good Protestant, I don't know any Irish. I know that Bruscar is rubbish because I've seen it in bins in Dublin. And I know that La is ladies because I've seen that in toilets in Dublin. But I remember going on to this Irish English online dictionary and discovering that just typing in journey and it came up Turas, and thinking, you know, I hope I've got that right. But my wife now works in an integrated primary school, so she was able to talk to someone who was able to cross-reference the title for me. But the book is written more than anything else to provoke readers, and I feel very strongly that I don't have any answers. But I do have a lot of questions, and I would hope that whenever somebody reads it, they will set it down disturbed and less comfortable when they picked it up. And a friend, Andy Flanagan, who's also an alumni of Portadown College, he wrote the foreword to the book, and he really captured the essence of it when he said this in the foreword. He says, "This is an important book. You may end up laughing, crying, ripping out pages, or throwing it across the room, but that's partly the point. Perspectives that previously came up against a no-entry or do-not-disturb sign in your brain or heart might just sneak in to annoy, enlighten, offend, or challenge you." Now, all in, the book took about 5 or 6 years to write, and it went through 5 versions of various long-suffering friends and family, reading drafts. And I also got some guidance along the way, I should say, from a guy called Damien Smith at the Arts Council of Northern Ireland, who was very helpful. But it is incredibly difficult for a new author to get published. I would be absolutely the first to admit that Turas was always going to be a book with very, very limited commercial appeal. So in autumn 2010, I decided to go down the road of self-publishing, and the book was published early last year by an imprint called Matador, by a publisher in Leicester called Troubadour. So that's the kind of nuts and bolts, which is maybe what you didn't come to hear tonight. So talk about the proper bit and the important bit, which is the story itself. Turas means journey, and in essence the book is all about the spiritual journey of these 7 Protestant Unionist friends in 2020, in the first year of United Ireland. Now, I think it's very important to say that In choosing the year 2020, I am not trying to be some Ulster Protestant Nostradamus. And, you know, 2020 is very obviously something that lots and lots of polls could be picked in, and it is quite monumentally unlikely that that is going to happen, or if there's going to be any unification in that timetable. But whenever I wrote the book, I wasn't setting out to factually predict the future. And when the book talks about how it is, the unification came about, all it's doing is setting in place a context and a background that allows the more important spiritual themes to be explored. And the book focuses on six men who are members of a local church, and they meet regularly in a house group or a small group or a cell group or whatever term you want to give that. And they gain a seventh member at the start of the year in the form of Peter. And Peter is a mixed race South African who has family roots in Ireland, who has returned here due to work commitments. And insofar as the book has a central character, Peter is it, because he's an outsider and he brings insights to the locals that were unable to see themselves. And this is what Peter says of the men in the introduction to the book. He says of these men who came to be his friends, nobody met them at the top of a birth canal and asked them to tick a box to say that they wanted to be Ulster Protestants or Irish Catholics. They simply came out and were placed in their mother's arms and took what they were given, as we all do. Yet those mother's arms and those father's influences, as well as the churches and the schools and the politics and the shibboleths and the history and the versions of the history, all of that was what formed them. The choices that we have in life are, I believe, much fewer than many tell us that we have. You can choose how to react, but you often have very little say in what you are reacting to. The men I met and came to call my friends were going on a journey, but no one asked them if they wanted to go on. All of them responded in different ways, and this is the story of where the journey took them. Now, broadly speaking, and there is more to the book than this, there's three aspects to the plot. Firstly, there are the events of 2020, and the book works through the calendar year with particular events happening and occurring that throw up opportunities for both discussions among the men, as well as allowing for quite internalised writing that describes how it is they're experiencing particular events and responding to them. So there's events like St. Patrick's Day, there's Easter, which is obviously important from both a Christian perspective, but it's important too to the Irish Republican calendar. There's the 12th of July, there's Remembrance Sunday, there's Christmas. There was a number of anchor points for the year that allow for particular aspects of the past to be explored. And then a second aspect of the plot is a number of Bible studies that the men do together, and they're all based on the book of Jeremiah and the theme of exile and separation that is at the centre of that book, and that creates opportunities to biblically unpack all that the men were going through. Now, if I'm honest, I set out at the start to write a very wordy book made up of those two things, and the first drafts were indeed wordy, but they were also, I would say, crushingly hard work for any reader. So what I did then was, in later drafts, I tried to humanise the story with a strand of plots, or rather a couple of subplots. So one of the men, for example, enters into, one of the younger men enters into a romantic relationship with a young Roman Catholic lady, and in so doing, he bites off much more than he can chew. And it's interesting that I wouldn't set myself up as the next Maeve Binchy, but actually, that was a bit that I most enjoyed writing, and actually that relationship was what was most enjoyable to me. And then there's another man who is another member of a group who's a retired policeman. That's maybe a darker or more difficult thing to deal with, but he has a skeleton in his past. something that he did or rather didn't do that emerges over the course of the book. And those aspects of Turas really colour the issues that the book was actually trying to explore, and it makes them much, much more real. And it also allows for a wee bit of humour in places as well. And maybe a lot of what I've been saying sounds very serious, but a number of people have encouraged me by saying that Turas is in places quite funny. And one person, for example, encouraged me about a chapter that is built around a really good turn or burn Northern Ireland evangelical funeral. And I mean, just a good evangelical funeral is just a fantastic platform for a bit of humour. Something else that emerged in the rewrite and that effort to humanise the story was a stronger role for Peter. Peter's that South African who has local roots. And I mentioned earlier that Peter has a capacity to see things in a way that others can't. And he's the prophet within the story, really. And what I did then was, in addition to the men studying Jeremiah, I introduced a number of shorter, punchier sort of instances throughout the book where things happen to Peter or he makes a certain point, and in that way he's imitating the style of a sort of Old Testament biblical prophet. Now, maybe that seems a wee bit contrived, and it's actually a device that I find quite hard to explain, but generally speaking I think it's something that broke the book up a wee bit and added to the book. So just for a few moments that remain while I'm on my feet here, let me touch on some of the big issues that the book explores. I think the single issue that these seven men struggle with most, the issue that comes up time and time again, is their sense that this Irish unification that has come about is actually a vindication of years and years of Republican violence and tactics throughout the Troubles and the years that follow after that. And the first challenge that that throws up for these men is it disturbs their evangelical conviction that in order for there to be grace and forgiveness, first of all, you've got to have confession and repentance. And how, they ask themselves, can there be reconciliation when so many of those who have perpetrated the very worst deeds appear so fairly unrepentant about what we've done, what they've done? And of course, what one set of people view as terrorism, others would argue is armed struggles. But to the protagonists of Turas, at least, the fact that these people, we've all heard people talking about these people, the fact that these people have apparently come out on top seems manifestly unjust to them. And that leads on to another challenge, which is the doubts that all of this creates in their head about God's sovereignty. Because when you read the Bible, and I must say this is something that I struggle with at times in terms of my own faith and my own doubts, you know, books of scripture such as the Psalms are absolutely riddled with passages where the bad guys, very often referred to as the wicked in the Psalms, get their comeuppance and the good guys come out on top. And to the men of Turas, Irish unification seems just to be an unbiblical turning of the tables that is entirely inconsistent with the will and the character of God, because their view is that the bad guys have come out on top and the good guys have lost. And those challenges, whether repentance is necessary for there to be forgiveness, and how we can believe that God is sovereign and just when things don't go our way, are absolutely enormous. And needless to say, they are not resolved in the course of the book. And of course, it's all the more challenging for these men because, like a lot of Ulster evangelicals, they pride themselves in their certainty. Certainty is a big part of the people that they are. And they're very sure that they're right. And they're very sure that the other side is wrong. So it's not just that their new experiences call into question their beliefs, but it also calls into question the forthright attitude that underpins the whole way that they believe. So that's the first sort of big theme of the book. A second theme of Terras then is that grace has to be social as well as individual. I think we're very fixated in Northern Ireland on faith at the level of what Jesus Christ has done for me and what Jesus Christ has done for my soul. And you know, it's interesting if you look at stories like the Good Samaritan, but Jesus links together the question of how it is that we inherit eternal life with who is our neighbour and how it is that we treat people, because however important it is, Jesus says, that we love the Lord our God with heart, soul, mind and strength, the real evidence of how authentic our faith in Jesus Christ is actually found in the way that we treat other people. And one of the recurring themes of Terras is these men realising that they absolutely must get to know their Roman Catholic neighbours, and they've got to understand them and they've got to love them. And it can't just be an optional extra in the Christian faith. As one of the men says, for the lefty Corey Miller types, the beards and Moses sandals were geared just like people here tonight. It's got to be. You know, as I said earlier, and Robert and Maureen are both here from Warringstown, as I said earlier, I mean, the place it is for me, the local church, I really, really enjoy it. And I wouldn't say that Warringstown is a jewel in the crown of a Presbyterian church, but it is compared to a lot of churches. It's a success story. You know, numbers are growing. There's a great mix of ages, and there's a vitality and a vibrancy around that particular congregation. But, you know, I've been going there 10 years, and I think I could count on one hand the number of times that I've ever heard of mentioned the fact that we live in a divided society. And if it is mentioned, it's a point in the sermon. It's not something that as a church family we're actually going to go out and really do anything about. And I think that is tremendously sad. And I think gatherings like tonight are great and fantastic, but I would certainly love to see these sorts of conversations and discussions being mainstream in local churches up and down our land. Thirdly then, Terras touches as well on the question of what is it that actually really binds us together in life. It's not something that I'll go into detail on now, but how important really in the grand scheme of our lives is national identity. Now maybe that's a very naive thing to say, because frankly national identity isn't very important to me, I hope, in the grand scheme of things, but I know that for many people in our province it is. But certainly one of the themes of the book is that despite all of the pain and the hurt that these men go through, one of the things that they experience is the wonderful reality that the love of a good friend or the love of a good woman is way, way more powerful and way more significant in anyone's life than national identity. And yet, for all that I might make that point, and that very worthy point, of course another challenge that they face is that they absolutely can't think of themselves as Irish. And in terms of news and sport and politics and all those things, they perpetually look east. They never look south. And of course that's one of the many contradictions of being an Ulster Protestant, because we don't want to be Irish, and we do want to be British, and most of us don't actually seem to like the English very much either. And we're not sure who it is we trust or like, but we're very sure of what it is that we don't like and what it is that we don't want. But for me, if the book has one single overarching theme, it's this. Quite simply, that Jesus Christ is Lord. That everything but everything has to be brought under Christ. And of course it matters to me whether I'm Irish or Northern Irish, because if you scratch all of us hard enough, in this country. We're all going to be either orange or green, but that is an absolute sideshow compared to the most important part of my identity and all of our identities, which is to be a disciple and a follower of Jesus Christ. Now, just finally, two interesting asides to ponder. First of all, my book focuses on the Ulster Protestant story because that's who I am and that's the people and the subculture that I know. But there was a number of times when I was writing it when I thought, you know, this could actually be told another way. One of my favourite sitcoms, and maybe I'm ageing myself a wee bit, because it's very dated, but I don't think it's dated, is Dad's Army. I absolutely love Dad's Army. And, you know, sometimes you hear or see in documentaries about how great British sitcoms were remade for America. And I remember seeing a clip once of Dad's Army remade for America, and it was absolutely terrible and crass and dreadful. But, you know, whenever I was writing Terras, I remember thinking I'd be really fascinated to see someone write a complimentary book to sit alongside Terras. And I'd be fascinated to read the story of a set of nationalists or republicans who are committed followers of Christ from a Roman Catholic tradition, working through what for them would be the faith implications and the community implications of having to accept that Irish unity is right off the table for another 100 years or another 150 years. So I've written one side of a story, but I'd absolutely love to hear that other side of a story. And secondly, and this is where I'm going to end, this book is actually only fiction. And it's interesting that one of the things that I've been doing over the last year is talking a lot to my mum and dad about family history, because I'm conscious that people are getting older and aren't going to be around forever, and yet memories are still fresh and minds are still vibrant. So it's good to talk to people and get a lot of notes made and explore a lot of things. And I've been learning over the last number of months how my dad's dad, my grandfather Neil, who died 3 months before I was born, I've been learning a bit about him. And he was Abraham William Neil. And he was born in 1909 in a hamlet called Street in County Westmeath. And I have actually been to Street in County Westmeath, and it is just a street, and nothing other than a street. And the Neils were Anglicans, they were Southern Protestants. And in 1922, as the War of Independence raged, friendly Catholic neighbours came to them and warned them that they were in danger. And they found themselves in circumstances where they had to pack what they could and get out very, very quickly. Now, my dad says that family legend has it that these neighbours put them on the back of a cart and covered them over with hay, and that covered over with hay, they were therefore able to get through Republican checkpoints. Now, Dad has reservations about that, and whether there's a degree of urban myth to that. And he says there's also a story about his grandmother having to bake bread for these Republicans at gunpoint and this sort of thing. And whether that's true or not, he's not sure. But what is not at all disputed is that when they ended up in Tandragee in County Armagh, they were effectively refugees. And I've written this work of fiction, not really knowing the truth that is in my own family. And of course, a truth that must in all sorts of innate ways have informed prejudices and attitudes and views in my family. And I've written this book of fiction, but just two generations before me, real people had real experiences that are actually not at all a million miles away from the characters in Terras. So they say the truth is stranger than fiction, and only time will tell. I think the choices that my children and my children's children have to make, and the stories, the real stories, that are in front of them. So thank you for listening.